dare not go. Now you raise your prophet's hands to touch the very nest of God, an intercessor for grounded souls whose gaze yearns toward paradise. I walk the cobbled dust, watching where my foot stumbles over last winter's ruts, and strain to see you in the sun. Then as your fiery ship swings low, you who have touched his creative finger, turn your priestly hand, palms earthward, and send a blessing down on me.
Now, wait, don't read your limerick quite yet. Okay. I mean, that's like, would you talk about that for a minute and then read it one more time?
I'm from Reno, which is very famous for hot air balloon races. And I've sat through several of them, and sometimes, you know, you see them, you can hear them before you see them, and that's the fire heating the air, and it goes up. And then sometimes they get in a bad current, or they run out of hot air, and they come down really low, and they're right over your head, and wave to them. And I've thought about it. In fact, I was in a situation like this, stumbling over ruts, this rutty road where I walked to the university, and I have to watch my step because it's pretty rough. And here he is up there sailing along. And I think he's so close to God, I wonder. And I was very blue that day, and I wondered, could he maybe send some of that blessing to me? Mm. So that's what I was writing.
That's great, yeah. Read it one more time.
Again? To the hot air balloonist. Wonderingly, as the 11 watched him until a cloud hid their eyes, I watch your reedy basket rock against the sky like baby Moses on the Nile. And as he climbed the summit where mortals dare not go, now you raise your prophet's hand to touch the very nest of God, an intercessor for grounded souls whose gaze yearns toward paradise. I walk the cobbled dust, watching where my foot stumbles on last winter's ruts, and strain to see you in the sun. Then, as your fiery ship swings low, you who have touched his creative finger, turn your priestly hands, palms earthward, and send a blessing down on me.
Mm-hmm. Sounds great. Yeah, let's hear a little bit.
This is in response to our last Tuesdays on Emily Dickinson. And I thought we really should say a little bit more about her. So it's called In Defense of Emily Dickinson. In Amherst, Miss M. Dickinson had a bad rap as attic-bound Lou. But Miss D. was foxy. She was paradoxy, for she loved the Rev. Witherspoon.
Yes. Oh, I get it. Okay. Yes. That was one of her friends that she wrote letters to. And
he actually visited her at they knew each other.
Yeah, and when he moved, it was like devastating for her, I think, wasn't it?
I think so. She wrote a poem, and I don't know whether it was at the time that he left, but it certainly was a very heartfelt poem about losing someone and trying to forget it.
Yeah. Well, very good. That's I like limericks, did you bring yours?
Or
you
can?
She can run and get it.
You can run and get it.
Oh, no. Yeah.
We have 45
minutes.
Well, I.
It doesn't have to be good.
Oh, you got some back there?
Yeah.
Or you're just. There's still time for like a lot of you just to write one. Get busy.
I'll go first. This is called, it's just a sketch. There was a moment between the drops, before one splash was silent and the second began, that I saw you clearly. This was before you said goodbye, even before I told you to, before there was a need for words that would have been muffled anyway. It rained that day, and you sat in the rain, because we had no other place to go. You stared at the trees in the distance. People say the world stops sometimes like this, or else we notice its fleeting nature. I just saw your coffee and rain.
Now, you don't have to, but you wanted to say anything about that?
I Don't know. I was just sitting in a bar and wrote a poem. So there's not, I don't think, I mean, there's not a story behind it or something.
Just an image that you had. Read it one more time.
Yeah, would
you? There was a moment between the drops, before one splash was silent and the second began, that I saw you clearly. This was before you said goodbye, even before I told you to. Before there was a need for words that would have been muffled anyway. It rained that day, and you sat in the rain, because we had no other place to go. You stared at the trees in the distance. People say the world stops in times like this, or else we notice its fleeting nature. I just saw your coffee and rain.
I like that image of raindrops.
Yeah.
Or they're not raindrops. Where are they dripping from?
I guess I thought they were raindrops.
Oh, they were raindrops. that's neat because it really draws up a sense of silence. And what did you mean by it before I told you to?
I don't know. I just had this whole thing, I guess an image of two people sitting there and saying goodbye to each other, and one person says, time to say goodbye.
It's time to say goodbye.
Ah. You know.
Is that one you've just written recently, or?
I wrote it earlier this spring.
So you write poetry?
I wrote that.
And you've got one?
Yeah. This is not a tree poem.
That's all right.
Okay.
We'll find a tree, you know.
I don't think you will.
Literary critics can find images.
But my question is if you can find a Lutheran in this poem.
Okay.
It's called Learning Lutheran Sex. It wasn't spring. It was the third Wednesday in Lent, and our principal was pulling the heavy vinyl curtain between us, boys on one side, girls on the other. Our fifth grade split like a cross-section of a tulip. Here is the stamen, here is the pistil. And behind us on the plaster wall was Jesus, bleeding and with downcast eyes. A white cap nurse gave each girl a sanitary napkin and the vocabulary we would need. Erection, menstruation, fertilization, reproduction. She piled up words like mortared bricks. The movie was called Growing Up and Liking It. It showed an animated egg clicking along the fallopian tube, a product on the conveyor belt of early automation. We saw the outline of a naked boy, heard the nurse say, of course you know about wet dreams, the words escaping like Houdini's doves. Did she mean that dream about the swamp where snake-like monsters swelled with venom? We knew there were other words unspeakable engraved in toilet stalls and written in our hearts the words of scripture. Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost? Each girl held a sanitary pad, wide and long as our Girl Scout troop's raft. As we stood at the edge of the swift current, without the strong arms of fathers and brothers to guide us, we would learn to ferry ourselves from this world to the next. I have one other one.
Sure, keep going.
Can we get to plant the trees the first one, please?
Mom, read your turtle poem.
Well, I think we've had enough of that theme. I wrote this one after seeing, it's a painting, it's Daniel and Lyons Den. It's a painting by Peter Paul Rubens. It's at the, at the Smithsonian, and it's huge. It's one of those huge paintings. You kind of walk in, you go, whoa. At dawn, the mouths of lions are tightly curled, their brows contorted with a deep and human rage. At the snarling center, a man sits, poised on one buttock, his body slightly tipped in an unmoving spiral, at the top of which his folded hands are clenched. A skull lies at his feet. The blood cascading down the rocks is just his garment, red and fallen. Rubens knew the ending of the story, but chose instead the moment of unknowing, the hour in which this man assumes the posture of a startled bride, legs crossed, his bosom hid. Aroused, the lions swarm around his naked body. Remember, says this painting, which one of us is in control here? Which of us is only color and light? Wait, what's the last line? I lost it.
Oh.
Remember, says this painting, which one of us is in control here? Which one of us is only color and light?
Is there a strong sense of sexuality in your poetry? Is that something silly to say?
No.
Only if you know her. Do you have one about trees?
I don't have one. I'm sorry.
She's got to get one about turtles.
Turtles. I'm going to read.
Is that your whole book? Is that all your
Several. My writer's group got together, and so it's, no, it's not all mine. It's several of us gathered our poems together. No, that wasn't a dumb question.
Okay.
No, it depends on the poem, but.
Okay. both of them, they seem like a bit.
I've got a tree one here. Does anybody else have one they were going to read to? Or I'll read this, and then I just want to talk even a little bit about writing poems just for a minute. You know, I mean, I'm always curious about the process. But this one's called Mission Statement. And, well, I'll just read it, and you can listen. Just one page. Mission statement. To push up where I'm watered, an accidental, dropped parent plum by wind, log rolling purple down the grass, too close to the side deck. But settling still in shadow of my fruit womb, heavy with myself, warm plum too ripe for prune, so straight to melt. To rise two tangled years unnoticed, vined by berries, then one spring to bloom into significance, shock white, tall as the tanager hops in the next tree, already necessary, like gospel immediacy, and safe. To sway through time by quarters, not to worry seasonally. When young, to frenzy wave with grace from the roots, like daughters to their daddies, never still. When told in later years, to leave enthusiasm in as many words as plums, to bloom for life, sky-sweeping joy, to give occasion for people to arbor pormorphize, and to show what can come from landing too close. And just a quick comment on that. And I went out of the village a couple days ago to get checked by a doctor, and I was told to like not move for a while, so I was sitting on this couch like for 12 hours. And so then I thought, well, I'll write my tree poem. What?
You didn't think that?
I didn't.
Oh, I told you to write your
poem. Well, Kay told me to write my tree poems.
It makes a difference, I think.
You can believe whichever version of this you want to. Anyway, there's just one little window where I was, and there's I was sitting in the lake house at 25 Mile Creek, which is next to the bed and breakfast. And so couldn't quite see Lake Chelan, but there's this little tree right outside, right off the deck, and it was just sort of waving around out there in the breeze. And I don't even know what kind of tree it was, but I was imagining it was this plum tree then that was there. And then on the wall there at the lake house was the Holden Village mission statement. So I thought, oh, well, I'll write this mission statement for this plum tree that's growing there. So this is like the voice of this plum tree deciding what its purpose in life is. And that's where that came from.
Can you read that for us again? I mean, sure. You're saying you should always hear this thing more than once.
Well, yeah, I could, although we didn't get to hear your tampon poem twice.
Sanitary Catherine, that was a good thing.
We didn't have that option back then.
Yeah, but we were on the male side of
it. Okay, so mission statement. To push up where I'm watered, an accidental, dropped parent plum by wind, log rolling purple down the grass, too close to the side deck. but settling still in shadow of my fruit womb, heavy with myself, warm plum too ripe for prune, so straight to melt. To rise two tangled years unnoticed, vined by berries, then one spring to bloom into significance, shock white, tall as the tanager hops in the next tree, already necessary like gospel immediacy, and safe, to sway through time by quarters, not to worry seasonally, when young to frenzy wave with grace from the roots, like daughters to their daddies, never still, when told in later years to leave enthusiasm in as many words as plums, to bloom for life's sky-sweeping joy, to give occasion for people to arbor pomorphize, and to see what can come from landing too close. And arbor pomorphize is not a word, I just...
It is now.
I made it up. I was going to say, to give occasion for people to anthropomorphize, and my editor said, no, I hate that word. It's not poetic. So I said, well, how about if people get to dream about being like trees, what word would that be? And I mean, that's what I'm...
What does anthropomorphic mean?
You know, anthropomorphic means, you know, you project human qualities into objects.
Okay.
So to project yourself into a tree, it's not quite, that's not quite the right word, but that's what I was getting at. Let me flash up that poem, the crabgrass poem. Some of you saw this already, but some of you didn't, so I'm going to flash this up there. And I just want to talk about analogies for just a quick minute. Does anybody else have one now they're still waiting on that we're trying to decide whether like these were bad enough that you could compete?
Angela, did you bring yours? She should have. You want to go get it?
There's still time.
No, there's still time.
You've got it memorized, though.
No.
She wrote a really good poem yesterday.
Oh, shoot. I'll have to give it to us at Vespers. This one, crabgrass, some of you saw this before. If you don't think of yourself as a poet and you don't write poetry, try it. This is a type, one of the types of poems that I go into kids' classrooms and say, think about this. And so I'll just sort of like to think about this for a minute. Some of these other poems we've already heard, I mean, are based on analogies. And there's an interesting book, it's called, The Private Eye, Thinking Through Analogy or Thinking by Analogy, and it's published by this outfit in Seattle. And it's got a subtitle, it's called 5X Power of Seeing or something. And what it's referring to, what this whole scheme is got kids doing is taking a jeweler's loop, you know what those things are, those eyepieces that jewelers look through, or just a little tiny magnifying glass, and it gets kids looking at whatever they want to write a poem about or whatever they want to study scientifically, and everybody gets one of these things and they're all looking at it up close, and then I mean, this is an interdisciplinary approach to emphasize it. Science, investigation, and creative processes, and poetry writing. There are all certain sort of processes and mental techniques that are very similar between them. So to get kids looking at these and writing a poem, you just look at your objects. So in this case, I just brought in some crabgrass, and all these kids are looking at this crabgrass up close. And then not writing a poem, but just brainstorming what they see. And really with two questions in mind. What, and they're analogy questions. Thinking by analogy, again, this book is talking about it, is part of the heart of the creative process, whether it's science or literature or something. Thinking by analogy, so to ask, what else does it look like? So the kids are all thinking, you know, what else does this piece of crabgrass look like? But you're seeing it differently because you're looking at it up close, and it just helps break through the, especially with kids, if you just show them things, what does this look like? They say, well, it looks like a piece of grass. And they'll just sort of give you the literal. But all of a sudden, if you're looking up close, they'll come up with analogies. So what else does it look like? And then the other question is, what else does it make me think of? And than to write not a poem, but what this book calls bones for poems. This is the heart of what will become a poem, or become an essay, or become something to study more about. But I just a couple months ago read this, and I kind of like that notion of brainstorming, and what you're writing is bones for poems, and then you put it together. Anyway, so this is, they created the bones for this. They, whatever they saw, I wrote down, and then I just smashed really everything they said together and didn't edit out anything, and it became this poem. And again, I'll just read this. Crabgrass. Why does it make my parents so crabby? It's beautiful. A new racetrack with lanes. Each spear is folded in the middle like a boat's keel, gliding silently down prairie streams. Amongst the darker, shorter grass, it looks like a silk scarf, ribbed, with zebra stripes, waiting to be picked up and smoothed against your face. Look how it sprouts everywhere, like bouquets of shoelaces in the lawn. Ouch! But stepped on, sharp, a snake, it bites. And pulled between your fingers, sticks, like a dry water slide, or discarded corn husks. Who needs this kind of beauty in the lawn that grows two for every one my parents pull and turns their smiles to stone this green Medusa's hair? So that's a third and fourth grade combined class, and thinking by analogy. You're reading your poem too. I mean, there's some great analogies in that poem that really, I mean, that just sort of sung out, that were just fantastic. I'd like to show one more Robert Frost one, which is an apocalyptic poem, or near apocalyptic, and then I've got a couple stories. It's after apple picking.
You didn't want to show this one again?
I did it yesterday. So.
Oh, okay. Polar bear fuzz, I like that one. So after apple picking?
Yes. It's next to the frost pile.
Oh, wrong way. Nope, still not far enough.
You'll have to shift once I get started. Can you see that? After apple picking, another tree poem. My long two-pointed ladder is sticking through a tree toward heaven still, and there's a barrel that I didn't fill beside it, and there may be two or three apples I didn't pick upon some bough, but I am done with apple picking now. Essence of winter sleep is on the night, the scent of apples, I am drowsing off. I cannot rub the strangeness from my sight I got from looking through a pane of glass I skimmed this morning from the drinking trough and held against the world of hoary grass. It melted, and I let it fall and break. But I was well upon my way to sleep before it fell, and I could tell what form my dreaming was about to take. Magnified apples appear and disappear, stem end and blossom end, and every fleck of russet showing clear. My instep arch not only keeps the ache, it keeps the pressure of a ladder round. I feel the ladder sway as the boughs bend, and I keep hearing from the cellar bin the rumbling sound of load on load of apples coming in. For I have had too much of apple picking. I am overtired of the great harvest I myself desired. There were 10,000 fruit to touch, cherish in hand, lift down, and not let fall. For all that struck the earth, no matter if not bruised or spiked with stubble, went surely to the cider apple heap as of no worth. One can see what will trouble this sleep of mine, whatever sleep it is. Were he not gone, the woodchuck could say whether it's like his long sleep, and I describe its coming on, or just some human sleep. see the apocalyptic images in that one? Wes, help us out. You see anything there? And I'm just thinking of this, you know, you pick up this piece of ice off the trough and look through the world, through the veil again, and the world looks different, and then the veil, the ice breaks into a million pieces, and I mean, there's the veil being broken in this poem. I mean, and when the veil gets broken, I mean, that is the apocalypse. What's going to happen when that veil gets shattered? And in this poem, I mean, it just sort of continues on where it started, with thinking about picking apples and physical memory and dreams and how they are all somehow connected into this image factory that keeps going together and together.
Much like the loop-breaking, also had a harvest, and we get what you get.
Yeah, interesting.
Well, and the other piece that really lives for me is, you know, when the person is shutting their eyes and they're going to sleep, and, you know, they have these thousands of apples that are coming after
you. Yeah.
How many times, like when you go hiking or, you know, something like that, and then you fall asleep at night and you shut your eyes, what's the image that comes to you, you know, behind your eyes, or like, you know, the waterfalls or whatever it was that you saw that day?
And the great harvest in this case, I mean, is an image from Revelation. I mean, that's straight out of Revelation. I mean, the great harvest is the image of the apocalypse. I mean, that's what happens when this all starts to come down. This poem, I love the way this begins. It seems like this poem peters out. You know, and you say, well, I mean, everything poets do is intentional. So, I mean, to think, I mean, why this poem could have had a big finish. But it doesn't have a big finish. Is that why?
Yeah, because he's tired.
Going to sleep.
But the question at the end is, what kind of sleep is it he's going into?
Yeah.
Is it an ordinary sleep and or a longer sleep? I mean, the woodchuck's going to hibernate, but then you automatically think of death, I think. I do.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, so I mean, like, if I die before I wake type of, I mean, he's even thinking about that type of image, or if the world ends before I wake up, what's happening next? But what I think is, when I think of this poem as not having a big finish, I mean, you don't get the apocalypse in this poem, you just get somebody thinking about, you know, what happens at it. You're not getting it. At least you're not getting the big bangs. Okay, I've got one story I'd like to tell. It is a tree story. This is a Holden tree story, and it segues right into another story that is a short written one, and I'll read it. And this first one, I was trying to think about what tree stories do I associate with Holden, and my family's been coming up here since I was quite young as a kid. So many of my memories, and I mean, still most of the things I think about Holden are seen, I think, through the eyes of a kid coming up here, since I was 8 years old or something. And I just remember one time when I was up here with Kay's family. This was long before we were married. We were about 14 years old or something. And we were just getting to the end of our week up here, having a family vacation. And I mean, Kay's family and mine have known each other for going way back. So I say, you know, back when there was a fireplace here, you know, we sort of fell in love watching the embers chase across this fireplace. Anyway, so this was back before love, certainly. And we wanted to squeeze in one more little adventure before we took off out of the village. And we knew what time the bus was leaving, so we four of us, two and Kay's brother and my brother, went up to the third level by the, you know, the mine stuff up there, and there's more buildings up there then. And the warehouse up there, still there now, it's gone. But it was always, I mean, all that stuff is intriguing for a kid, but you could go up that warehouse, had hanging off at this kind of stairwell made of concrete. It was hanging, I mean, hardly even attached to the building anymore. You could walk up it, and it would sort of bounce up and down as you went up to the second level. So, and we played up there before. We went up there, and you just sort of bounced your way. And then you're on the second floor of this thing, and there's no roof anymore. So it's this kind of
interesting place because there's walls but no roof, and you could see out and you could see the valley. So we were just up there having a poetic experience. And while we were up there, suddenly we heard this loudspeaker calling, "Landsverk children, Landerholm children, where are you?" Coming out of this bullhorn, and we knew.
And of course, it echoed over the.
And then we saw this car drive up, "Landsverk children, Landerholm children, where are you?" And we knew we were doomed. I mean, we were someplace we weren't supposed to be. You know, of course we knew that. And out of the truck stepped Werner Jansen, the do everything manager up here at the time. And so we came creeping down these stairs knowing that we were going to be reenacting, or had already, the fall. And instead, I still remember this, it's just absolutely clear. He opened his arms and he said, "Get into the truck." The boat came early, everybody's gone down the hill already in the buses, and we're going to try to get you on the boat so your families can leave before it's gone. And I mean, he opened his arms, you know, you're expecting the fall, and you get instead the tree of life, you know, welcoming you in. And I mean, the end of the story, then what the buses were all gone, so what they did, they stuck us in the luggage truck, which they had held, and we got to ride down in the back of the luggage truck. You know, a kid's dream come true. So, you go in expecting what you deserve, some kind of punishment, and you get instead grace. And to me, that's been a great image of what Holden sort of represents, which leads into this other story that I'd like to conclude with. And... No, I think I can see. And this is a true story that happened about a year ago now in Bozeman. So I didn't make this up. And I'll just read it to you. It's a page. "I was in my basement office working when Kay called down to me as she is wont to do, interrupting my thoughts." Which you've already got a little sample of tonight. So, "What now?" I responded rather grumpily. "Will you come up here, please?" she called. "Can't you come down?" I mumbled to myself as I clumped up the gray wooden steps, where I found something unexpected. Instead of a question about the calendar or scheduling the kids' activities, Kay was out in our driveway talking to someone sitting in the passenger seat of our car, someone I didn't recognize. With a beautifully fine-lined face, resplendent with wrinkles, even more so because she smiled when I peeked in the window. The trouble was, she didn't recognize herself either, at least a good part of herself. She knew her name, it was Kay as well, or so she said, and she was a bit surprised we didn't, since she had lived in town for more than 80 years and we should know who she was. But she couldn't remember much else, not even how long she had been walking that day. My Kay had encountered her in our front yard, obviously near exhaustion. She was confused and lost, so she sat down to rest as Kay offered to help. "How far away is your house? I'll take you home," Kay offered. They found her last name in the phone book and discovered the address wasn't far. But when Kay had driven her there, the door had been locked and the woman had no key to the house. They had just returned to our house. That's when I was called upstairs. It was a funny situation for all of us, puzzling in the driveway over a case of identity and belonging. Where did this woman belong? Who might be looking for her? Fortunately, she wasn't upset. In fact, just looking at her brightened my day. With her generous smile and a charming embarrassment at her memory loss that oddly put in my mind the image of a shy teenager, she struggled to remember. She finally recalled that she'd rented out her home and didn't live there anymore. Though that's where her feet had been going when Kay had stopped her, following a path they no doubt had traced 1,000 times since her now dead husband had built the house. But Kay, if that was even her name, for my Kay wondered if the woman had simply echoed her own name when Kay had introduced herself, but that Kay was saying She couldn't remember where she belonged, where she now lived. We all laughed together a bit and waited, thinking of some way to relink present and past. That's when the epiphany occurred. R.K. was rummaging through the yellow pages and mentioned church for some reason. The new K, the old new K's, her face brightened. Church? I go to church. I've always gone to the Presbyterian church. And again, the spring smile. Kay dialed from our driveway, but the line was busy and stayed busy, so they drove off down the few blocks with Bozeman's treed streets, still naked in their winter undress, the piles of snow-broken branches from a recent spring surprise lining the way in jumbled clumps, a crown of thorns on the grass at each street corner. The pair of Kays parked and walked in, my Kay holding her breath. Would they know her? Would they know where she belonged? She didn't have to wait long. Immediately, as they stepped into the office, the secretary called out, "Kay, it's good to see you. What's up?" This story ends with members of that Kay's church family taking her home, though I'm not sure she ever really left. She had, of course, wandered away from the Bozeman Care Center, as it turns out, on a lovely spring afternoon, walking at least 2 miles, forgetting some recent details, but as Thoreau says, our life is frittered away by detail. But she had encountered a namesake friend, another Kay, whose name also means joy. And ultimately, they both knew where she belonged, in God's hands, at church, of course. Where else? Later that evening, R.K. cut some resilient daffodils from our garden, and with Allison, it's our daughter, dropped by the Bozeman Care Center to bring that K a gift. My K wanted to make sure that that one's day ended better than it had started. I don't know what Allison was thinking, or either of the K's for that matter, as they sat chatting, this time in a comfortable but small room without the wheels of a car under them. But I'll bet it had something to do with eternity. T.S. Eliot, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Landsverk children, Landerholm children, all you children, where are you? We're here, up here, inside. My Kay knew where she was when that Kay walked by, and that Kay, looking back, knew who and where she was, had never forgot. A child of God in God's hands. Hosanna. Both Kays had been given the gift of that by their parents, their families, their church, by Jesus' open arms, as have we.
I have a verse.
You do?
Yes. I'm a genealogy nut, and this just came to me.
Huh.
My family tree is part of me. Those gone haunt me. I look back, yearning. They are part of me, and I am them. What part, I wonder, came from whom? Amen. Mm.
That's a great benediction, I think, for the session. Thank you. Thank you for coming and sharing today and this week for those of you who've been here.